What makes your palms sweat? Perhaps it's the thought of speaking in public, or maybe it's something deeper, a nameless dread that creeps in at 3 a.m. Fear is the most democratic of human emotions, yet its expression and meaning have transformed dramatically across centuries. Consider this. In Victorian England, men were considered more bashful than women, while women's social anxieties were blamed on tight corsets restricting blood flow. These aren't quaint historical curiosities. They reveal something profound about how fear is never purely biological, but deeply shaped by culture, time, and power. What we fear, how we fear it, and even whether we admit to fearing it at all, tells the story of who we are and what we value. From medieval terrors of divine punishment to modern anxieties about climate collapse, fear evolves alongside civilization itself. This journey through fear's history reveals not just what scared our ancestors, but what continues to haunt us today, and why understanding this emotion matters more than ever in an age of constant threat alerts and algorithmic anxiety. Death anxiety isn't hardwired into human nature. During World War I, soldiers feared cowardice far more than death itself. One wrote, "Death is not a deep-rooted instinct. It is the least of fears when confronted with duty or battle." What people feared about death shifted dramatically across centuries. 19th century anxieties centered on premature burial, being trapped alive in a coffin, conscious but helpless. Edgar Allan Poe captured this terror in his fiction, while newspapers reported hundreds of supposed cases. Eleanor Markham's story became infamous. Witnesses claimed she awoke in her coffin crying, "You are burying me alive." By the 20th century, this terror had flipped entirely. Modern people feared not dying too soon, but lingering too long, kept alive by machines after pleasure and consciousness had ended. Death moved from homes into hospitals, managed by physicians rather than priests. Medicalization created new anxieties: distrust of doctors who might harvest organs prematurely, fears about brain death definitions, worries about becoming hooked to tubes. The terror of the deathbed transformed, but never disappeared. December 30, 1903. Chicago's Iroquois Theater became a death trap when a floodlight ignited drapery during a matinee. The fire curtain stuck, emergency exits were locked, lights went dark. 600 people died, not from flames, but from trampling each other in blind panic. This disaster transformed how society understood catastrophe. Earlier tragedies, like the 1881 Tay Bridge collapse, were seen as divine punishment. But by the early 1900s, disasters became secular problems, requiring scientific solutions. Professional engineers replaced religious authorities. This birthed a new science of crowd control. Psychologists portrayed crowds as easily transforming into mobs where emotions became contagious. Architecture responded: wider exits, better lighting, panic release bars, strategic seating. The built environment became a tool for controlling collective fear, a legacy visible in every fire drill and emergency exit today. We've engineered our spaces to anticipate our panic, acknowledging that terror can override reason in seconds. Working-class Victorian children grew up surrounded by death. Kathleen Davenport recalled being lifted to view a deceased girl in a coffin, describing her as like a great doll, waxen and with long hair, an experience that left her petrified for years. By the 1920s, child guidance manuals warned against frightening children with death and hellfire. Middle-class mothers increasingly sheltered children from frightening stimuli. Films were condemned for traumatizing young viewers, with studies claiming 93% of schoolchildren had been frightened by motion pictures. Fear itself became pathologized, portrayed as capable of causing epilepsy or rendering children permanently neurotic. But a minority warned against overprotection. Some argued that mollycoddling retarded emotional development, that courage must be learned. Stories circulated of sheltered children unable to respond in emergencies. John B. Watson offered a new framework. Fears were conditioned responses that could be unlearned. This debate continues today. Should we shield children from frightening media or gradually expose them to build resilience? The answer remains contested, revealing deeper anxieties about childhood innocence and preparing young people for a threatening world. River's work with shell-shock soldiers demolished Freud's wish fulfillment theory. Combat nightmares replayed trauma with documentary precision. The whistle of shells, screams of dying comrades, exact moments of explosion, manifesting the opposite of sufferers' desires. The 1953 discovery of REM sleep revealed crucial differences between REM nightmares and NREM terror dreams. The latter produced severe physiological responses, blood pressure spikes, pulse rates exceeding 180 beats per minute, profuse sweating. Victims often bolted upright, unable to distinguish reality from dream, yet remembered nothing by morning. Some nightmares manifest as phobias, fears persisting despite focusing on commonplace objects. Vincent developed agoraphobia at 12 after his playmate was murdered. Decades later, he couldn't cross bridges without overwhelming dread. Despite outward success, he secretly considered himself a nervous wreck, weak, worthless. Freud attributed phobias to sexual tension, interpreting Little Hans, a 5-year-old with horse phobia, as displaced Oedipal conflict. By mid-century, lobotomy emerged as treatment, creating surgically induced childhood. By the 1950s, psychoactive drugs like Thorazine made such surgery obsolete, ushering in today's pharmaceutical age. Combat transforms fear into something elemental. Surgeon George W. Crile described soldiers preparing for battle becoming activated, heart pounding, hands trembling, body flushed, as physiology prepares for attack or escape. He described combat as orgasmic, with soldiers finding supreme bliss in hand-to-hand killing. Military psychiatrists faced a paradox. In combat, normal was always pathological. Trembling, sweating, diarrhea, and incontinence became responses soldiers must learn to live with. Modern warfare created unique psychological challenges. Invisible enemies and long-distance killing frustrated natural fight-or-flight responses. By World War II, mass destruction obliterated distinctions between civilians and combatants. After September 1942, British civilian death rates exceeded soldiers until D-Day. The nuclear age birthed new dimensions of fear. Beginning in 1951, American schoolchildren learned to take cover at nuclear flashes, wearing identification tags constantly so people will know who I am if my face is burned away. September 11, 2001, crystallized diffuse anxieties. Surveys revealed a quarter of Manhattan children showing significant psychiatric symptoms, doubling among those who witnessed attacks firsthand. Yet, despite pathologizing fear responses, many demonstrated remarkable resilience, coping well in frightening situations, sometimes even embracing feared experiences. Fear reveals more about who we are than what threatens us. The Victorian woman fearing tight corsets and the modern parent fearing screen time both respond to anxieties shaped by their cultural moment, reflecting deeper tensions about bodies, control, and safety. We've replaced supernatural terrors with scientific ones, swapped fear of premature burial for fear of prolonged dying, traded divine punishment for climate collapse. Yet fear's fundamental function remains unchanged, marking boundaries between safety and danger, self and other, the acceptable and the threatening. This carries dangerous consequences. Throughout history, fear has justified exclusion and violence, from moral panics about vulnerable groups to post-9/11 scapegoating. Anxiety seeks a target, and the marginalized become convenient receptacles for collective dread. Yet, understanding fear's constructed nature offers liberation. Recognizing that our terrors are shaped by culture and power, not hardwired biology, grants us agency. We can question which fears serve us and which serve systems of control, distinguish protective caution from paralyzing anxiety, and choose courage as action despite fear. In a world selling security through surveillance, perhaps the most radical act is recognizing that our deepest fears often reveal not what threatens us most, but what we've been taught to fear, and asking who benefits from that lesson.